This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo on your community radio network.
Autism. What is it? Why are so many children being diagnosed with autism?
Asperger's syndrome. What is it? And is it different to autism?
What are the most common characteristics of autism and Asperger's syndrome, and how do they vary within each individual?
Joining us in the studio is Richard Eisenmeyer.
Dr. Eisenmeyer is a clinical psychologist. He has published a number of articles about autism and Asperger's syndrome.
He's spoken at numerous conferences to inform educators, families, support personnel and individuals with autism and Asperger's syndrome. Today, Dr. Eisenmeyer will share his wealth of knowledge with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Richard, oh, we're going to call you Richard. I got the whole doctor thing.
That's right.
I don't think I've ever had to call anybody doctor.
Even your own GP.
I refuse to.
Good. They are people.
I'm making a stand.
I don't call my doctor.
Don't you?
By the first name, yeah.
No, you have
Hello,
to.
Hello, David. Yeah.
Hello, David. Now, Richard, what's the most common question that you ever get asked in your practice?
Probably, what is the difference between autism and Asperger's syndrome? What do these words mean?
Okay, well, let's start with autism. A lot of people would have heard autism, and there's a lot of people that have or know of within their family or their circle of friends a child with autism. So let's start there.
Well, we've known about autism for a long time, for about 50, 60 years, and I think the community understanding of autism sort of comes through TV and movies and things like that, really. So, you know, that film Rain Man was, you know, a very good depiction, actually, of that much lower functioning form of autism. I think the big change that's happened in the last, say, 10, 15 years has been the idea that you can have a much higher functioning form of autism. So there is actually a category that we call high functioning autism. And this is where we start talking about, you know, the non-disabled end of the spectrum. So our clientele at that end of the spectrum are lawyers, GPs, dentists, vets, accountants, librarians, CSIRO scientists, lots of computer programmers, yes. Lots of engineers, architects, graphic designers. This is at the end of an autism spectrum that we would then class as having... Asperger's syndrome. So people then ask, well, what's the difference between high-functioning autism and Asperger's syndrome? And the throwaway line is the spelling of the words. Okay. They pretty much mean the same thing.
When you say spectrum, can you explain the spectrum?
So let's talk about a spectrum from the lowest functioning to the highest functioning type of character. So everybody on this spectrum, this autism spectrum, would have problems with three main areas of everyday functioning.
Okay.
You'd have problems with social skills, you'll have problems with two-way talking skills, and you'll have a problem with your imagination, and when you're younger, your play skills. That's actually called the triad of impairments, and it's unique to autism spectrum disorders.
Okay.
Now, this is the tricky bit.
You can be
a very, what we'd class a low-functioning character with autism. So you have probably a very significant intellectual disability. You may be 10 years of age, but have the social awareness of perhaps a 12-month-old child.
Okay.
You cannot talk. You are nonverbal. So, you know, again, you're 8, 10 months of age in that sense. You may... be 10 years of age and never known how to play with a car or a train. You would suck on it. You'd spin the wheels in front of your eyes. You would smash it against a wall, much like a 6-8-month-old child might. So that's at one end of the spectrum. Under social, communication, imagination, you've got this very, if you like, hardcore end of autism. At the other end of a spectrum, you know, like think of a rainbow type spectrum.
Yep.
You can have somebody who is 10 years of age and socially eccentric, quirky, interested more in the teachers at school and the history of the teachers' cars that they've owned since they were 18 years of age, looks out in the playground, sees kids playing soccer and footy and just thinks, why would you do that? You get muddy, dirty and wet.
Okay.
And what do you get?
That's a whole playing. Different thinking for a child.
Oh, very different. So they relate better to adults rather than kids. You may talk, in fact, like an adult because your vocab is extraordinarily good. Yep. Your IQ is off the scale. And in terms of imagination and play, you're more interested in perhaps construction, design. You're 10, but you're interested in programming things on the computer rather than just playing games on the computer. So, and we would still class that person as autistic because socially they are not quite fitting in to what we would call the mainstream.
Well, in the mainstream community, then they'd be thinking that this person is really quite an intelligent, smart
Absolutely.
Person. Okay.
Genius.
And they are.
Yeah. Well, they are,
exactly. In fact, we don't call it Asperger's much in our clinic when we talk to 10-year-old boys and girls with this brain. We call it expert syndrome, specialist syndrome.
Okay.
And these kids rather like hearing that, okay, I may not be a footy star, but by golly, I could be a fabulous engineer one day.
So when you're talking about that, the specialists, now, yeah. A lot of kids have special interest in a lot of things. Now, there's probably a top five, isn't there? I'm assuming there's trains.
Yes.
Engineering, so it'd be some construction, maybe bridges or something like that.
Well, we have our Lego Meccano crowd, yes.
Okay, so we've got trains. Oh, I'm trying to think of another one now. Give us some
more. Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, Bakugan. If this is I know far too much about these things. And then the whole Dungeons and Dragons crowd. So we've got medieval computer games and things like that, and then tripping into the sort of World of Warcraft thing after about 12, 13 years of age, and we get World of Warcraft junkies. So they're that's a pretty good,
dinosaurs.
Oh, and yes, we have our dinosaur experts. Now, what's interesting is people will be listening to this and thinking, well, I've got a cousin or a nephew or a son or whatever that, also is obsessed with dinosaurs. I have a 5-year-old boy at home who will be listening to this and he'll be thinking, well, I love dinosaurs and, Bakugan as well. But the thing about people with an autistic brain is that their interest is just often their range of interests are just narrower than the average child. So my child won't go into the playground at kinder or school just talking about dinosaurs and, why they are now extinct. He'll go in there able to talk about whatever is kind of going on. And if it doesn't suit him, he can back away and then come back later to see whether he's interested in perhaps a child, very bright Asperger child, would go in and try to dominate the interaction and just say, look, we play this way today.
Yes.
We call them the directors of play. And that's when fights and arguments, we have, these genius 5-year-olds, saying, well, he's so smart, but he doesn't know how to interact with others. He's bossy, stubborn, violent, aggressive, blah, blah, blah.
What's the general acceptance of people, of children who suffer from autism in the community? Is the community well-educated on it or a little bit ignorant to it?
Look, in all honesty, I think it is getting better. 15 years ago, we weren't even using the term Asperger's syndrome very much. There weren't a lot of people around diagnosed. The numbers a while ago were, 4.5 in 10,000 births being diagnosed with this condition. The latest figures are sort of 1 in 100 to 1 in 150. Now, that's a lot of people
Absolutely.
Out there. That's a lot of schools that are having every year one or two kids coming through their system. There are some schools with 30. In a school of 1,000 children, some of these high schools have 30 kids on the spectrum. So, and that just forces the rate of diagnosis has gone through the roof because we're getting better at identifying these characters. They've always been around. We just thought they were naughty.
But just technology and medicine now allows us to recognise it more.
And a lot of training, So there's a lot of people that have chosen to sort of work in this area because it's actually a fascinating area once you get into it, and that just forces more people to be knowledgeable about this area.
When you were talking about the triad before, you were talking about the communication differences and imagination you were saying some of the social problems is that they dominate conversations. Yeah. What are some of the other social... I think historically autism was seen as the very, very aloof.
Yes.
What...
Rain Man type presentation. So somebody who, you know, so we see these kids very young, 2, 3, 4, they come in because people know that there's something quirky and, well, very delayed, actually. I shouldn't say quirky, very delayed. The kid's not looking at their parent, you know, mum's talking about not being able to hold their babies and having to breastfeed while the child's lying down because they can't be touched. I mean, this is, you know, sort of a very severe form of it. And they come into, you know, my office and they're more interested in the table legs or the computer wires than the people in the room. They've got that very cut off, you know, they're cut off and in their own little bubble, if you like. And often actually quite happy in that bubble. And they're flicking fingers in their eyes and rocking and moaning away. They're actually sometimes quite settled and having fun. It's just that when we try to ask them to go to the toilet or walk out of the room, that's when we get, you know, a big reaction and a scream. So because that's our social request. We want them to come out of their own little bubble and to join our world. And they, we think, can't see why. And how do we know this? Well, we're diagnosing genius characters that are very able at describing what it's like being in a social world when you're actually, your wiring, your brain wiring isn't programmed to be part of this social world, this large group people environment.
So when these kids are not socialising and they're quite happy in their little bubbles, yeah, are we considered weirdo freaks? There's a term that they use for us, isn't there? Yes.
They call us neurotypicals and they're Aussies and Aspies. And, yes, we're just brain normals, you know, boring average people and who just like sitting around chatting to one another all the time. Why would you want to do that when you can reach another level on a computer game?
So with the social pragmatics, with that kind of social interaction that we learn as a child when you're on the breast and you're learning to interact with the parents, is the brain wired differently? Have they been able to work out that physically those messages are not getting through?
Yes, absolutely. These people have a different style of brain. They're not brain damaged. It's just different centres of the brain are working much, much better than other centres. So... if you like, wiring-wise, they have, say, in the visual centres, these people are extraordinarily visual people. They're not sit-around chatty types, usually. Yep. And so they are very visual. And so if you see a three-year-old flicking fingers in front of their eyes, they are actually stimulating the best centres of their brain, where you and I might do that and think, gosh, that's, you know, what would you get out of that? And you, if you're a graphic designer and you forget to have breakfast, lunch and dinner every day because you're in front of a screen visually stimulating yourself, you'd be considered, you know, an expert, rather thin one, but, you know, and we have, you know, people tapping on the shoulder saying, you know, have you had lunch today? Well, no, I'm trying to finish this. So there is a different, you know, there are certain signals that they are missing. And some of those are the social signals, you know. And yet, because other parts of the brain are completely dominating those weaker parts. So it's a very uneven profile of skills.
Can it become a very isolated world for
absolutely.
An individual?
Yeah. I think that, I don't know if you've seen that Mary and Max film that was out last year about a, you know, New York middle-aged fellow with Asperger's who essentially became a hermit through, you know, being rejected by society, trying to interact with this social world without the full set of skills and enough rejection, you tend to start giving up. We call some of the 15-year-olds that we see in our clinic vampires. You know, they stay up all night home. They say, "Oh, I'm going to homeschool. I'm sick of being told off by teachers and getting rejected by my peers. So I'll stay at home and homeschool." They do that for about 2 days and then end up staying up all night, sleep during the day. You ask them why. Are you depressed? You know, what's the matter? Very logical, the response, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously. They'll say something like, "Well, the internet speed is quicker at night. The fridge and pantry are my own, and I don't have to see mum and dad." And I say to the parents sometimes, "Look, I think we've lost him for 2 or 3 years because he's not depressed. He's actually having some time out from this place that we've been sending him since kinder. We've been asking this kid to interact in an environment that is so darn hard. I mean, just very quickly, I mean, while I went to school to socialise, talk and play, social communication, imagination. I didn't go to school for the work.
No.
I went there for my friends. That's why I went.
Yeah.
Recess and lunchtime was why I went. If that you find that to be algebra, if you have to think every single time somebody moves their hand, their eyebrow, that sound coming out of their mouth, you actually have to think. It's work. You know, school ends up being a pretty tough place.
It certainly does.
It would be a tough place. Mm. We're going to have a bit of a dive into some of those behaviours that autistic kids display. You've mentioned a couple of them already, so we're going to look at that just after this. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo on your community radio network. We're here with Dr. Richard Eisenmeyer talking about autism. We've been talking about some of the behaviours that autistic kids have. Three of the main ones that I can think of are repetitive behaviours, echolalia, and I had another one written down, but of course I'm so autistic now, I'm non-autistic, I've moved my piece of paper. What's the third? Eye contact, the lack of eye contact. I pulled it back in, did you notice?
And so, very good. So do you want to know why do these people have some issues with those three things?
Yeah, I want to talk about those, like echolalia.
Okay. We'll start with the echolalia, that's an easy one. So when you have a normally developing child, you know, how do you start to learn to use language? You copy the sounds and words that are around you. So it's actually a very normal stage of development between, you know, 14 and 24 months of age to copy things. And so, you know, I've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they went through an echolalic phase of development. It's how we learn. Now, when I was talking about much lower functioning characters before, usually people with an intellectual disability, if you get stuck a little bit in terms of development, right? So your communication centres in your brain sort of get, you might be 10, but your brain has only gotten up to, if you like, in terms of its development, to an 18-month-old stage of development, you will likely be echolalic. So you can ask some of our characters that come into the clinic, do you want a drink? And they just parrot back, do you want a drink? And sometimes they do want a drink, and sometimes they just walk away. And so they're just parroting back. And so it's a state, and they kind of get stuck. You know, I remember when my kids were babies, you know, what do babies do? Babies stare at lights and flap.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, gosh, how autistic is this? Because their brains are, you know, very, people say, some of these people have noise sensitivities or sensory oversensitivities. They don't like touch or smell or you know, they'll taste, put things in their mouth. Well, what do babies do? You know, babies do all of those things. They explore their world because my son at 16 months of age, if we had the vacuum cleaner on or the lawnmower on, he'd run a mile. By two, he wanted to push the vacuum cleaner around. His brain had developed to the point where it wasn't overfeeling these certain things. He flapped when he was very excited at 12 months of age. He wasn't flapping at 2.5. If he had have been, I would have started getting a bit more interested in thinking, gosh, what's going on here?
Well, I'm over 40 and I still flap. I get a bit excited.
That's right. Exactly. And that's right. I mean, so we can all be a little bit like this sometimes. We might talk about that later. And, the eye contact thing I think is very interesting. I think it's more to do with that we've got a very, very visual brain here that we're dealing with. So when I talk about these people being architects and graphic designers and computer programmers, and they're very good at those things because they love visual information. Or some of these people are amazing artists as well, because what's happening in their visual centres is just extraordinary. Now, the problem with people information, when we look at people, as I'm looking at you now and talking to you, you are constantly moving your face.
Sorry about that.
Yes. Now, if I was autistic, that would be terribly distracting. And if the listening and talking parts of my brain weren't very strong, but my visual parts were, all of this darn information that you're projecting to me right now would be terribly distracting as I'm trying to use the weaker parts of my brain. So what I might do then is actually look away to turn off my visual centres to then start focusing on answering back and staying relevant and, you know, all those what we call pragmatic issues of communication, trying to figure out how best and most efficient to talk to you. So that's why we think a lot of these people do look away, because we are very distracting.
Something that I noticed, because I am in the area of teaching and I do know a lot of kids with autism, is there are a lot of people who actually say, look at me, and they're really focused on getting this kid, and they're going, look, they're looking at me.
Yes.
But can it be quite painful for these kids?
Yeah, a lot of higher functioning people with autism, I call it Asperger's, high functioning autism, they will say that, you know, well, why should I look at people? What's the point? Why should I shake somebody's hand? Why, in fact, should I say hello? All these sort of, you know, these sort of social requirements that are out there are not the main thing that I'm concerned with. This is somebody with autism speaking. So, yes, you need this, and you are in the majority. You're an NT, so you expect these things that your brain just does effortlessly. Well, for me, how do I know whether I should shake your hand, give you a kiss, nod, say hello, say g'day, say how are you? How do I know what to do? This is incredibly complex stuff, and they want rules. And we sometimes just have a sense, a sort of a social gut feel type sense of what to do. Well, people with autism are often flying blind with that sort of people. Interaction, if you like, and struggle to know what to do, then get very nervous about it. And then if they're verbal, we'll often say, well, why should I do these things?
Okay. So obviously when they are struggling with that simple concept, things that are obviously important to us that we regard as having manners, you know, the hellos and the goodbyes and that. I mean, I have a nephew who's probably on the mild side on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things you're saying are just alarm bells going off in my head.
Yes.
Do they not understand that the hellos and the goodbyes are just, to us, are really important? Is there a part of their brain that doesn't understand that? Or
I don't know if it's not understand. I think they, after some time, especially, you know, nagging mums usually and teachers sort of saying, you know, look at your auntie in the eye and say hello, you know, and you get a grunt out of them. And people say he's six, but he's acting like a 16-year-old.
Okay.
And he sort of grunts and, you know, dismisses me. You know, why doesn't he do this? Well, I would argue that it is hard work. You know, you want to know what it's like to be, you know, somebody with autism, you know, get a year 9 maths book and do 6 hours of algebra a day.
Yeah.
And I want to know how social you feel after 6 hours of minute after minute algebra.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So this is work, right, to do this. And why should I? You know, it's I was just thinking of a GP that I see with autism or Asperger's. And I said, gosh, you work with, you know, 30, 40, you know, patients a day. How the hell do you do this? You know, you're not a people person. He said, yes, Richard, but only for 8 minutes at a time. And I laughed, and he laughed as well. He knew it was funny, but he was trying to say, look, I can do this for a bit, and then bang, as soon as I leave my room, I get in front of my screen, I do my notes, I rest, I take a break, and then bang, I do my acting. Okay. And that's what he is doing. He's going through an act. But it's work.
So the rules that these people learn, they actually literally need to be spelled out. And I know a teaching strategy is to actually write them down. And if this happens, then this happens. I know of a case where a professional man had to have instructions of, you know, if the tram was late, actually pull out a card and say, if the tram is late, it's okay, I can catch a cab.
He's actually my client who you're talking about. Yes, that's exactly right.
Yes.
And so he needed that because he was more concerned about the tram being late, and that this is rather annoying because on the sign it says that it's meant to come at 7:45 and I'll give it 10 minutes, but I'm not going to give it any longer than that. And then he essentially had a panic attack, but he was having a tantrum because something went wrong. And he couldn't, in that state of high anxiety, couldn't think through what his wife had been telling him for years. You know, just get your phone out and call a cab.
Like he's going to listen to his wife.
That's, well, you know, he tries, but he's not an auditory guy. This guy had 20 years of psychotherapy listening to people all the time. And by the time he got home, he'd forget 99% of what people, it's just kind of the Woody Allen syndrome,
yes.
You know, 40 years of psychotherapy and still stuffed. So, so what he did, he essentially just needed a card. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. And this guy has genius IQ, owns a big, big company, is a computer star. And, you know, he just needed a visual reminder. He said, now I can get what I have to do because I can see it rather than focus on words.
I love that story. It's one of my favourites. In fact, I think I have those cards.
Very good.
If I've been out drinking.
That's right.
This is how I get home.
Keys.
Now, I want to ask a couple of questions to each of you. Are you a little bit autistic? Now, Rob and Sue Larkey, who does the conference thing, and she's a teacher of autism, and she's an amazing speaker. If you haven't heard of Sue Larkey, definitely look her up on her website. Are you a little bit autistic, Rob, with your toilet paper? Now, Sue always asks this question, because Sue's do. Now, is it go over with the flappy bit down, or does it go to the back with the flappy bit under? How autistic are you?
To the back, with the flappy bit at the
it
back.
It has to be. Now, the point is that Sue makes is that if it's on the wrong way, if somebody comes and changes your toilet, do you actually rechange it and put it back? Yes, you do.
Yes.
Now, Richard?
Absolutely, my gosh.
Which are you?
Of
are you the over?
I'm an over guy. Every time. You come into my office, you come into my home, it's always over.
It's got to be over.
In fact, I don't understand the other way.
Well, I like the other way. It looks better.
Is it a looks better thing?
It's a looks better thing for me, yeah.
So everybody is on the spectrum at some level, aren't we? Surely we are.
I sort of joke. The first time I read a book on Asperger's, I diagnosed myself and half the males in my family because this is a very, very male brain. So it's actually interesting when you think about this that, you know, you hear about these books, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus type things. What those things are getting at is that, you know, there is some wiring differences between males and females, and you know,
there's
a very interesting theory going around about whether is autism, is Asperger, this spectrum of autism. Where does it sort of end? What you know, does it just sort of float off into the, you know, the normal neurotypical continuum? Yeah. And one researcher has. I got this great idea, and he said, well, actually, is autism just the extreme end of the male brain, the male personality? And I have, you know, a lot of sympathy for that because I think, well, and you look at the numbers, okay, we diagnose 8 or 9 boys for every 1 girl. In fact, when you see autism in a female or Asperger's in a female, it's almost not quite right. You've got this very male brain in a female, and it's quirky, this very visual brain that's not chatty, not small talky, and I'm making great, you know, sexist probably.
I know, I'm sitting at
that's right, stereotypes. But there is this sort of you know, that when there are large scale IQ testing of the population, so when they're norming IQ tests out there, what do they tend to find between male and females? That there tends to be a slight increase in visual strength on the average male out there, and less verbal, and on the opposite sort of. It's just a slight sort of difference between males and females. And people are wondering, well, is Asperger's just super, super visual? So we call them supermen.
I know, I was
super
waiting.
Males.
Yeah.
And much lower verbal skills, right? And I've got a lot of sympathy for that that theory. I think there's something to it, actually.
Just do more males than females suffer from it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
There is no doubt. But although we think we're underdiagnosing, well, there's a lot of opinion out there that we're underdiagnosing the girls because it's interesting, they don't present as often as clearly as the males because they're better actresses. Right, they're more concerned about fitting in. They've got this sort of femaleness.
They can cover it up more.
Correct. Okay. You know, they're interested in being part of the group. They might be hopeless at being part of the group, but often their obsession is not computer games and dinosaurs. Their obsession is actually being part of the group. So you see these 8-year-olds absolutely having, you know, meltdowns every morning, making sure their clothing is perfect, their hair is perfect, because if I'm seen as perfect, maybe the group will accept me.
Okay.
And that's their sole obsession. So they don't often come to people like me at a youngish age because people just say, oh, well, look, you know, she's just such a socially orientated girl.
Okay.
Not a lot of my boys are like that. Okay. They're more interested in how many computer games have you got and have you got more than me?
Boys and dinosaurs and computers is boring. We are talking to Dr. Ridgen. Now I've lost
Richen.
It. Dr. Richen. We are talking to Dr. I did it again. Can you try that?
Dr. Richard Eisenmeyer.
Thank you. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo on your community radio network. We're here with Dr. Richard Eisenmeyer talking about autism. Richard, we've covered what is autism and Asperger's and how basically they're the kind of the same thing. It's just one end of the whole spectrum. we've talked about echolalia and eye contact, some of the behaviours and characteristics. I want to go into the diagnosis and understanding how these kids get diagnosed. Now, I know a lot of families have worries and concerns. Like they might say, oh, it started when they were 18 months old, or it started when I was pregnant, I walked through a chemical thing, someone was spraying, whatever. There's concerns about people having injections or the children having the MMRs or whatever. What is the medical understanding at this stage?
I think the overwhelming evidence is that it's a genetic condition, and this does run through families. So we have larger families that have three or four children at various parts of the spectrum. So much lower functioning to sort of genius level characters in this one family, and often the father. Because it's a male condition, it's often coming through the father's side of the family. It can come through mum's side. But more than likely to come through the father's side of the family. So there's been a lot of research about, you know, whether there's been, you know, problems during pregnancy or birth trauma, or whether the measles, mumps and rubella injection that babies are given can be the cause of autism. And those things, certainly the MMR debate is virtually gone, thank goodness. Kids have died around the world because parents didn't vaccinate their kids, and I don't think there's a lot of people around that would promote that theory any longer. And also with the early trauma and pregnancy theories, not a lot of people are doing work on that anymore because there's just no data supporting it. And overwhelmingly, the research is going down the genetic side of things.
How do they know then it's genetic? Is there a blood test?
No, there's no blood test. But they're working on it, and we think there will be, you know, maybe one day. You know, they always talk about 5-10 years we'll have one, but it's a very complex condition, and, you know, but there are, if you type in genetics and autism into Google, or Asperger's into Google, you'll read about very, very large-scale projects going on all around the world.
If someone who is autistic, obviously later on in life, has their own children, is there a possibility that one of their children will be
autistic?
Yes,
absolutely, absolutely. And we see that. So, you know, what we do in part of in one of your questions, Sue, is about diagnosis. One of the things, interesting things that we do when we're dealing with a perhaps more a non-intellectually disabled person with autism, so that end of the spectrum, often because we can't test them, they're coming in at 2 or 3 years of age, their sort of skills are perhaps at a 6 to 12-month-old level, so there's not actually much we can do. We do very basic things, but a lot of it's by observation and interview with parents or childcare workers and things like that, and to come up with, you know, as best a diagnosis as you can. The non-intellectually disabled end, so that more socially interested Asperger end of the spectrum, we give those kids IQ tests. And I was talking about strengths and weaknesses in brain function before. Yeah. Well, actually, that often plays out across an IQ test. So everybody focuses on overall IQ score, but actually an IQ test is made up of a whole bunch of different subtests testing different areas of thinking. And some Aspie kids have, you know, amazing strengths in certain areas and amazing weaknesses. So they get this very, very wonky profile. And then as we're going through an interview, once we test the kid and we think, oh gosh, this brain's working a bit differently to the average neurotypical flat brainer out there, the dad says, oh, by golly. And when we ask 100 questions, you know, of the parents, what's he been like since he was a baby? The dad often, you know, halfway through the interview, he starts saying, hang on, this is all about me. And we say, well, I'm very, very happy to give you an adult version of the IQ test. And lo and behold, what happens? Mm. The dad has virtually the same peaks and troughs on, and we can almost overlay it as a template. So this is what we call a style of brain. It's not a bad brain. In fact, these people are amazing people. We think these people are stars, but you've just got to get them through this big social environment. You know, school and kinder can be a toxic place if your brain is wired up in this way. So, yeah.
How do parents generally handle it or cope when they find out their child is autistic?
Or think.
Well, I think the build-up towards diagnosis can be very, very stressful because, of course, a lot of the materials that you might read on the internet and in books and or perhaps, you know, you see on, you know, tabloid TV shows and things tend to have, you know, very extreme stories about, you know, major dysfunction and, you know, lots of aggressive behaviour and non-conforming behaviour. We have, of course, some very sad days in our clinic. We do lots of assessments, but overwhelmingly people are relieved to know that what's going on. And now they are on a very different path in terms of parenting, for example. If you have, you know, a child that just doesn't always pick up on the right social cues at the right time, is a bit of a, you know, he's egocentric, thinks more about himself than others, he might be a genius 10-year-old, but he might be having a 3-year-old tantrum. A lot of people just think he's a spoiled, naughty boy. He's been underparented. So what do mums and dads do? Or, you know, because families are very good at giving advice about how spoiled their grandson is, for example. So what happens, you know, he's naughty and he gets smacked and all, you know, yelled at and put in his room and no TV, no computer. And that makes these people wild or depressed. So they either hit back or they internalise all this, just, you know, this sort of, why am I getting in trouble for just kind of, you know, being me?
Yeah.
And so parents then are relieved once a diagnosis happens because, you know, they can then get proper advice about how to parent this child and make him more of a two-way thinker rather than just a me thinker. So it's a very different style of parenting. Imagine raising a child and not using discipline. An incredibly difficult thing to do, and but it can be life-changing for that family. People say, just as a quick thing, people ask, why would you diagnose people with Asperger's? In fact, you'll have listeners thinking now, but these people are quirky, a bit different, but gosh, we need them. You know, universities are full of these people, not just the students, but the staff. You know, these people are stars, blah, blah, blah. Their IQ, you know, some of them incredibly wealthy, they're successful people. Why would you diagnose? Well, these people, because they are, you can't see autism. That's the big problem. It's a style of brain. You know, they're not Down syndrome, cerebral palsy.
It's a visual
thing. You can see.
Yeah.
Even if you've got an ADHD kid who's just visual, flipping out and hyper, you can see that. It's pretty obvious. You know, you put him on a pill and he calms down. Oh, gosh, you know, geez, he's got ADHD. People can see that. But autism is very hard to see, really. And so it splits families. It puts teachers on distress leave because teachers think, who is this child not conforming? I just have to glance at a kid acting up and he just gets it and knows how to simmer down. This autistic kid just stares me back and says, what's the matter with my face? Why are you so ugly with that frown? He's, you know, what do I do with a child like that? So, you know, diagnosis is often just a relief.
So obviously I'm assuming that diagnosis is better if it's earlier. Now I'm also assuming that diagnosis can be at any age for many
people. I diagnosed an 82-year-old engineer about 2 years ago, and he's a star. I won't tell you what buildings he built around Melbourne and Geelong, but they're still standing, I can tell you that. And they're kind of different, because he just didn't want to go with what everybody else went. So anyway, we diagnose 2-year-olds to 82-year-olds. I mean, it doesn't kind of matter when we prefer earlier. Obviously the lower functioning child is easier to pick up at a younger age, and we try to get them into early intervention centres. You know, so they might be 3 or 4 years of age, but they do need to learn if they're going to go to kinder and to a school of some sort. They do need to learn acting skills.
What
really
is early intervention?
Well, it's about, you know, having very intensive, if you like, input into learning skills that for other children come naturally, but for these people don't come naturally. So if you like, if you don't know how to talk, but you're 4... to communicate with the world, you know, what does a baby do? A baby or a toddler has a tantrum. We need these guys to learn better effective ways of communicating with the world rather than hitting or squealing. So we use, and Sue's already talked about, we use visual means. So we might have to teach somebody through visual cards and prompts, you know, a whole system of interacting with the world, just as an example, yeah. You know. And so that's often what we're trying to do, to trying to teach these people in some ways compensations to be able to function in a family or in a people environment, you know, because things aren't coming naturally, if you like.
Mm. Now, when you're talking about visual cues, mm-hmm. I know that in my work we actually use them. There's an argument that goes on, the older the person, if you introduce or use visual cues, it's actually causing a kind of regression and it's childlike using visual pictures. And I disagree with that. Mm. I think it's actually very worthwhile because as adults, our neurotypical lifestyle, we go into the supermarket, everything's pictured.
Well, that's
signs
true.
Are pictured. Do you have that... do you get those comments as well, that visual pictures are unnecessary?
No. I mean, look, and this is why I love the fact that we are diagnosing much higher functioning individuals that are writing books. I mean, one of the most famous books is, you know, called Thinking in Pictures.
I love that.
And, you know, and they do, you know. They don't think in words like most of us. They think in, you know, in sort of footage.
I know I have known kids who can do Shrek word by word
absolutely.
Because the movie's running across in there.
Oh, we've got lots of those guys. Yes. That's right. And so, you know, and that's so we should be using really actually the way we do it these days. I mean, look, you're right. 15, 20 years ago, what do we try to do with these people? We grab them by the chin and force them to look us in the eye. We used to squirt them with water if they flapped.
I do that with Rob now.
Stamp the autism out of them. These days we realise actually hand flapping is a very functional thing. If you're a very nervous person...
You flap your hands.
But your wiring is of a six-month-old in that sensory way, you might find that actually 15 minutes of flapping a day is a beautiful release and it's better than going on to, you know, some medicine. Yep. So we've actually learnt to use the best bits of these people's brains and make them as functional as possible. And that's why these days we use these visual systems to go through the best bits, if you like.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, what about some well-known autistic Asperger's people? Can we name a few?
I don't know.
What about Einstein? Einstein has...
he's dead, so I can talk about him.
Talk about... you're allowed to.
Yeah, I think, look, you know, when you read about Einstein, you know, apparently he never had a friend. He'd sort of look upon kids in the yard at school and, you know, be more interested in, you know, bugs and the stars and, you know, clouds in the sky and things like that, and sort of looked at this social stuff as sheer nonsense. I mean, it's very interesting, actually, when you... you know, he at university, I think, he used to sit in the front row and just criticise the lecturers, and then he couldn't understand why, when he went for a job at university, he got rejected and he ended up being a clerk or something. And then he wrote his theorems basically on his own. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a very, you know, solitude, sort of singular life, if you like. He wasn't a group person, we would argue. So there's lots of sort of well-known characters throughout. People talk about, you know, these Mozart type geniuses that again just had this amazing natural talent, but weren't part of, if you like, the social people world. So, you know, and certainly we have our characters. I know some very, very, very famous people. You know, we have politicians in this country that have got this brain, and you think, gosh, that's just such a social job. But, you know, if you're a good actor and you're an expert...
You can cover it.
You can cover certain things, that's right. And, you know, it's actually used well. This can be an amazing, amazing brain. And we don't joke that, you know, there are university professors that, you know, the absent-minded university professor... you know, we have them as our clientele, and they end up having kids with Asperger's as well, and they are experts. And the beauty of the university is it's an expert environment. Okay. They're fitting in. Yeah.
Well, I'm absent-minded, but I'm certainly no expert. Now, what about cures? The whole... I know.
It costs extra.
Yeah,
yes, that's right.
Buy one, get one free.
Yeah, that's right.
There's still that thing about... I often get asked, is there a cure? No. Do you get that question?
Of course. Look, how can I...
Say no?
Give, yeah. Look, you know, it's actually... It's a very interesting thing. So say you have a 50-year-old accountant who's successful in life and, you know, in whatever way they choose to be, and they're sort of pretty happy. You diagnose them, maybe because they've got a child with it, and obviously often their partner is saying, gosh, this is just you. I've read this book and this is all about you and our life together. And so they come for diagnosis, and you ask these guys, usually they're guys, you know, if I had a pill, would you take it to make your brain work in an average neurotypical way? I've not had one guy say, give it to me. But I would have taken it when I was 8, is a common reply. It wasn't much fun having this brain, because what's valued when you're a kid? Social skills, talking skills and playing skills, not how good I was at maths. And now I'm a star accountant and I've got 20 staff. You know, I've learnt to do social things in time. So it is actually, it's very, very interesting. You know, there are gay pride marches down the streets of New York. Well, there are now Aughty Aspie marches down the streets of New York once a year. Basically, it's people saying, we are the way we are and accept us because we're out there and you've got no choice. In fact, you might be working for one of us one day, you know, and I love that attitude. And so it's a bit offensive to talk about cures to people who, you know, are wired in a different way. And so, but if you're a parent and you've got a low-functioning kid who's rocking away, banging his head on a wall, squealing half the night on floods of medication, and, you know, I can understand why you'd be looking at, and of course the internet has just been a boon for shonks out there, like in a whole range of areas, not just autism, but, you know, saying, look, you know, this... you know, we can offer a cure. So look, we don't offer cures, we offer management, and we try to respect this brain. This is not about changing a brain, because you can't really.
We'd never have a building in Melbourne.
That's right, yes. Or people talk about Bill Gates having this brain, and if you read his life story, you know, it sounds very Aspie to me. And but there's history is flooded with these eccentric genius type characters who weren't part of the main social milieu. And I think, you know, the cure thing, I struggle with that whole idea.
I don't think it's a cure. I think I'm actually envious of a lot of these experts, because you go, not in the dinosaur thing, couldn't care. Don't care about Thomas the Tank and what tram number and whatever.
Yes.
But the whole, you know, to know and to understand something to an important level, to that high level, I am in awe of this.
Well, and in fact, can I just, but if you were 8, okay, you probably wouldn't, I don't know, but maybe that wouldn't be such a thing. And it's very interesting that I think as my clientele get older and understand themselves and where they fit in, and by the way, if they've been able to fit into a job or a partnership or, you know, a life of sorts, you know, often they're very, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. They think differently, but, you know, they're fitting in to a point. You know, I think we get more Aspie as we get older. You know, I look at my, you know, 21st birthday photos and I had 100 people there and I just thought I was Mr. Social. At my 30th, I had 4. And I sort of look at those photos of my 21st thinking, who are these people? You know, because I was so keen on, you know, being popular. As you get older, you know, I think these things become less important. And I think those years are often better for a lot of people with Asperger's, thinking, you know what, I don't give a stuff how many people. I've got 3 key friends. And yes, we communicate on the internet playing computer games, you know, half the time, but, you know, they like me and I like them and we get on fine. And, you know, I think it's easier as you get older. That social thing, that drive thing when we're younger becomes less important.
And you're not placed in those environments like schools, that whole...
Well, you have a choice.
Yeah.
What sort of workplace you might work in. Do I work with 3 people or do I have 30 people, you know? And we have team meetings all the time. And my clients who have to have team meetings every year, correct, they start flapping. That's right.
Yeah. I was flapping then because we have meetings at school to have about meetings.
GIS.
Can I ask, obviously for a family or for a parents to find out their child does have autism, are there a lot of support services out there for families to go to?
The 2 main ones in Victoria are Autism Victoria, and they're in Drummond Street. And then we have the Asperger's Syndrome Support Network. ASSN, so Asperger's Syndrome Support Network, and you can Google those. They're
are they
the
both
two
government?
Main.
Are they both government?
No, they're. Don't ask me what the acronym is. Okay. Non-government agencies, I think. But no, they get certain supports, and they have members that pay for. You know, it's a sort of community organisations, yep. Really. Mm. Okay. Often begun by, they have been begun by parents.
Okay. Mm.
And there's lots of reading. If you go onto those websites, there's lots of stories or access to different kind of books, like the book Thinking in Pictures.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So definitely check out those. Dr. Richard Eisenmeyer, it's been fantastic talking to you. I'm flapping a little bit, probably not because I'm
You're
nervous. Because I'm
excited.
Too much
talking.
Too much talk. I've had all this eye contact. If people do want to find out more, definitely Google. But I would say that you probably suggest just to be a bit wary of some of the sites. Probably go to those two sites.
That's
as your
a
main.
Great place to start because they have links to, you know, better vetted things. There's some terrible things on the net. So
avoid the cure sites.
I would, personally, I would, yeah.
Yeah. Except for you. Because your toilet paper's going to still stay on
there. Yeah, worried about that now. Worried about that.
I think Richard's going to go home and check his.
I know where it is.
I'll have a chat with you tomorrow, Richard. One of my own.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Allegro Non Troppo on your community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.